Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. We've interviewed several authors with terrific books covering how toxic our world has become. In Mark Shapiro's book, Exposed, we discover that the United States has become a dumping ground for toxic products since no other country will allow them in. They regulated them out. Shopping Our Way to Safety, Andrew Sass's insightful book, is about people who are trying to protect themselves with a reverse quarantine in their homes. And recently, Anne Steineman's groundbreaking research reveals to us all the toxic chemicals that are released as fragranced products volatilize. This isn't to scare you, it's to mobilize you. Today we look at how profoundly and permanently our children are harmed from the womb to the boardroom. We're joined by Alice and Philip Shabakoff to discuss their new book, Poison Profits. Shabakoff is S-H-A-B-E-C-O-F-F. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. The medical industry is up in arms against the pharmaceutical industry. The Associated Press, under the headline, Battling the Growing Influence of the Pharmaceutical Industry, reported last week on the growing band of medical industry leaders hostile to drug company influence over the decisions that doctors make. According to Catherine DeAngelis, an editor at the Journal of the American Medical Association, quote, the influence that the pharmaceutical companies are having on every aspect of medicine is so blatant you'd have to be deaf, blind, and dumb not to see it, end quote. She then goes on to say that doctors, quote, have just allowed them to take over, and it's our fault, the whole medical community, end quote. The way I see it, the so-called medical community is not at all the victim of an evil corporate master, a victim who, through inattention, allowed horrible people in suits to take over their medical practices. The medical industry, including the editors of the leading journals, in fact, were the ones who quite intentionally created this monster. Beginning about 50 years ago, with the increased attention on prevention of chronic disease, medical practice shifted from treating acute conditions such as infectious disease that last for a short period of time to treating chronic conditions such as heart disease that last for the rest of the patient's life. The medical industry worked hand in hand with the pharmaceutical industry to find solutions. Clever people in the pharmaceutical companies quickly figured out that this was a gold mine. They could develop drugs that would be sold to a patient from the day of the first prescription to the day the patient died. With the money that poured in from these pharmaceutical cash cows, companies did what you would expect any corporation to do. They used their mountains of money to buy influence that would keep the cash cow thriving. As the Associated Press article notes, although the medical industry is riled up, it nevertheless has a love-hate relationship with the pharmaceutical industry. On the one hand, doctors don't like being pushed around. On the other hand, they depend on the pharmaceutical industry's mountain of money to do research and develop new drugs. The medical industry's solution? Really strict rules on such things as gifts to doctors, how drugs are marketed, declarations of conflicts of interest in professional journals, and other lukewarm reforms of a kind that have never worked in any other industry. As one industry analyst observed, drug companies are very clever and will find ways to adapt. Quote, the earlier you can hook one of these doctors, the more loyal they are, end quote. Here's some basic economics for the medical industry. Right now, the road to treatments for medical conditions is controlled by drug companies using their mountain of money. The money is principally collected from insurance companies that collect it from payers of insurance premiums that consist of individual people, and employers that in turn collect money from the people who buy their products or pay taxes. At each step, a slice is taken out for administration and profits. So why maintain this road to treatment with such a Byzantine and ultimately corrupting process? Why not just allocate research money from our taxes, have the research decisions made publicly, and have pharmaceutical products distributed by a public agency? However, if you were paying attention, you'd recognize that this isn't the only problem or even the principal problem. The verdant growth of drugs in the medical culture it has spawned is firmly rooted in the fertile soil of a medical industry prone to overdiagnosis and overtreatment. The fertility of that soil comes from the predominance of treatments for disease prevention by a medical industry that is ill-suited to the task. It is increasingly clear that the doctor's office is the wrong place for protection and prevention. What we've come to understand is that our social and physical environments have a profound effect on our health, including a wide variety of medical conditions. Real protection and prevention will only come from profound political and economic change that prevents exposures to social and environmental toxins. The doctor's office is not the place to find these solutions. We'll find them is in living rooms, social clubs, community centers, churches, grocery stores, classrooms, street corners, legislative chambers, regulatory hearing rooms, and anywhere else that people can use their power to create a better life. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, a writer, and a health educator. He produces this show with me and is director of the Sustainable Health Institute at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Now to our topic for today, toxic assault on children. Our guests are Philip and Alice Shabakoff, S-H-A-B-E-C-O-F-F. Philip Shabakoff was the chief environmental correspondent for the New York Times for 14 years. He's appeared on Meet the Press, Face the Nation, CNN, and NPR. For his environmental writing, he was selected as one of the Global 500 by the United Nations Environmental Program. Alice Shabakoff is a freelance journalist focusing on family and consumer topics. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor, and the International Herald Tribune. She was executive director of the National Consumers League, the country's oldest consumer organization. And we're really lucky and happy to have you on the air, both of you. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, I'm going to need both of you, I think, to speak up a bit.
Yes, unfortunately, there's some noise in the background.
Oh, dear. Do we have both of you, Alice? Are you there as well?
Lena, I'm here, too. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you actually pretty well. All right. Well, welcome to you both. Either one of you can answer this question. I'm wondering if, as you collected the information in this book, did you worry about overwhelming and basically shutting your readers down, you know, with information?
Yes, we did worry about it, and we had a lot of discussions about it. However, this is such a controversial topic, and we knew it would be attacked by industry and by right-wing commentators, that we wanted to make it as heavily documented as possible so that our case could be as iron-tight as possible. And therefore, I'm afraid it may be a bit overwhelming, but so far a lot of reviewers think it's readable.
Alice, I'm wondering
Yes.
if you can talk to us a little bit about what your intentions were with the book, what you actually wanted to happen when somebody reads this book. What did you want people to do?
Lena, we were trying to reach just the parents, mothers, grandparents, pediatricians, people who are unaware of these facts. So we weren't trying to talk to scientists. We were trying to get at regular, the man in the street, the grandparent in the street. And when we put this together, we were hoping that that people could find both the information about what, enough evidence so that they would say, my God, there is a trend here. There is enough evidence here not to be skeptical anymore. And then, so to arouse their knowledge of what is lurking in so many of the places that look so harmless in our world, from plastic bottles to fake furniture, and then at the very end to give them a sense of hope and optimism for the future, as well as some tools that they can use in their home that are very practical and simple.
So, in fact, I am hearing quite a bit of noise on the line. Is that because we have a bad connection with you?
No, there are people mowing outside.
sorry.
No. Yikes. Okay. All righty. We'll persist then. That's an example of some toxic exposure right there, actually, with the gas and all of that.
You are quite right.
Yeah. All right. I'm also hearing a lot of rattling around, so I guess, boy.
That's fine, Cord.
We're going to tell them to stop, Lena.
Okay, and then also, I think it's going to be important, whoever, one of you's got a phone cord that if you handle it, you're going to hear a lot of clanking in the background, so
okay.
It's the art of being interviewed by telephone here that we're, Alice, I assume your tall and strong-looking husband has gone out to discuss the mower issue, so I will ask you this.
Yes,
let's talk about how these, now we're talking about children. We're talking about the most vulnerable population. But in general, let's talk about how these multiple pollutants get in, because I think one of the things that people don't realize is how much of this stuff is in their water supply and why.
So how they get in is from just about every avenue that you can think of, through the air. For example, some things that you've never heard of, such as a chemical called dioxin, which occurs...
No, we certainly have heard of that one.
Okay, which occurs when plastic is burned. It goes up in the air, flies through the air, literally for can be for thousands of miles, lands on the surface, and perhaps a cow eats it, and that's how it gets into your meat supply.
And your milk.
And your milk, including, unfortunately, mother's milk.
And actually, even on your vegetables.
Unfortunately, even if it's, you know, that's one of the problems. We have to stop these things at the root, because it's hard, even if you buy organic vegetables, to avoid just every chemical there is. So,
well, particularly because the water supply itself is tainted, and you're not going to water an organic garden with a filtered water. You know, it's going to be whatever water you've got. So,
exactly. Items like Prozac show up in our water supply, because even if it's treated, they can't get out all of the chemicals, and made more difficult by the fact that the pharmaceutical companies will not tell you what's in their chemicals, therefore you don't know what to look for. So these chemicals, although parents can protect their kids to some extent, these chemicals should be taken out of the supply right at the beginning. And we talk about how that can be done without disrupting America, without putting us back in the Stone Age.
Lena, I'm back amid blessed silence.
Thank you. Thank you, sir, for going out there and looking dangerous. Although I know you do not look dangerous, because there's a very nice picture of you guys in the back of your book, Poisoned Prophets. Again, we're talking to the Shabakoffs, Shabecoff, their book, Poison Prophets. So we're talking about the intrusion in everything of these chemicals, and particularly the fact that the water, no matter how much, I mean, if you filter your water, you're not going to be able to filter out hormones and psychotropic chemicals and all the rest of it, fragrances in the soaps and things like that. None of that is going to get out. So, you know, another thing I don't think people realize is how much of the chemicals that we're talking about are actually made from petroleum, too, which is kind of interesting given the fact that we're running out of petroleum.
Yeah, that was an astounding piece of information, that 90% of these chemicals are formulated from petroleum. And making up, in America, making up 80,000 different chemicals, not to mention the pesticides, which are also made of petrochemicals. Yeah, it would be good if we could find a base that was not petroleum for our chemicals. And, in fact, I believe that green chemistry is beginning to work on that.
Yes, we're going to talk about some of the solutions
good.
At the end.
By the way, Lena,
yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if Alice mentioned this when I was out silencing the mowers, but of those 80,000 chemicals now in commerce, only a fraction have been actually tested for their impact on human health, and even fewer for their impact on children's health. When chemicals are tested, they are tested for their impact on 150-pound adult males. And there's been practically no testing of the health effects of multiple exposures to chemicals. So as a couple of scientists we work with wrote, we're conducting a great toxicological experiment, and our children and their children are the test animals.
One of the things that people argue, we of course have been concerned in covering a lot of the cautions and concerns about the new wireless technologies and cell phones and whatnot and towers and all this non-ionizing radiation, because it's in fact, there's a lot of electrosmog and it's very thick, and there's only now just tiny bit of stuff leaking out about, well, gee, maybe children shouldn't be using cell phones to their head. So as you say, there isn't much thought to children. But one of the things that I run into, and I'm sure that you do as well, is that when you try to talk to people about this, they say, where's the research? Even after you show them the research, they say, where's the research? And indeed, where they're going for their information is the World Health Organization. Do you want to explain what's wrong with using that as a vehicle for educating yourself?
Well, I mean, even worse than the World Health Organization is, using industry data, which is where most of our information comes from. The industry, I don't want to say they lie, that they often put out information that puts the best possible light on what they're doing. And sometimes, in fact, all too frequently, they hide the impact of the impact of air chemicals on human health. We did not look into the World Health Organization, Lena. I really can't give a...
No, I understand you can't. I just think that what happened... Yes.
We can talk about the same kind of agencies that are overlooking public health in America and how they have been affected by overrepresentation of industry research and industry representatives.
Well, let me just give out some of the statistics in your book about children, because I think that people are missing the point. I see this in my practice, so I know this is happening, but just here it comes. One out of every three of the 73 million children born in America suffers from some kind of chronic illness. This is cancer, asthma, birth defects, neurological diseases, anything from ADHD to autism. One of every two pregnancies fail to come to term, or even produces a healthy child. The rates of increase over the past two generations are startling. Childhood cancer, which was a rarity some years ago, is now 67.1%. The U.S. is the fourth highest incident, has the fourth highest incident of childhood cancer in the world. Asthma has more than doubled. Learning and behavioral problems have grown sharply. The historic birth ratio of boys to girls is on the decline, partly because of feminizing endocrine disruptors. A sperm quantity has decreased 50%. Defects of the male sexual organs are on the increase. Infertility continues to climb. Women under 25, the group should have the easiest time giving birth, report the most problems in conceiving or carrying a baby to term, and a deformity of the uterus, I see this a lot in my practice, that can cause infertility, known as endometriosis, used to be very rare, now strikes twice as many teenagers as a year ago. Teenagers. So why don't you go ahead and talk a bit about who's supposed to be regulating and what they're not doing and how that's happening.
There is a hodgepodge of regulations, mainly FDA, which is supposed to be controlling cosmetic products, which it does not, EPA, which is supposed to be controlling industrial chemicals, like the things that go into air fresheners, and USDA, which is supposed to be controlling our food supply. So sometimes that crossing over, mixing up the regulations is one of the problems. But the other problem is that these agencies are not allowed to test. They are required to depend upon industry tests. EPA is absolutely not allowed to test a new industrial chemical. It has to wait until outside scientists come up with enough studies showing danger that they can then convene a panel to start looking at the product. So it has to reach ill proportions before EPA can take a step.
There's another dimension to this, Lena, and that is enforcement of the laws and the regulations that are on the books. And basically, the laws were not being enforced in this administration, but starting with the Reagan administration, which came into office saying it was going to get government off the backs of the people. What it really meant was going to get government off the backs of industry. You're seeing the meltdown now in the financial sector in the United States. A lot of that has been attributed to lack of regulation. Well, the same thing can be said about what is happening to our children. Free market ideology that says don't regulate industry, the market will take care of it, is responsible for the way corporations act, and they often act heedlessly of children's health because they can get away with it because nobody's going to enforce the law.
You know, what's interesting is that one of the things that's very hard for those of us who are concerned about these things to understand is what could possibly be. I mean, we know they're making money, but the corporation's end game. Because, you know, we see in Europe, as you mentioned, that it's possible to manufacture safer products. There is a, as you said, a movement called green chemistry, where you can produce things that are not horribly toxic to people, you know, or don't immediately get in through our lungs and our skin and blood, into our bloodstream. So you had mentioned that one of the things about what's going on is that industry, aside from making lots of money doing things the way they're doing it and having to retool, you know, and spend money to do it differently, is they don't want to be told what to do, which is the sort of attitude of it's sort of the popular attitude right now in the country. You know, there's something about this political atmosphere that creates this "you can't tell me what to do" kind of attitude, which negates the effect of other, you know, that we have on other people.
You know, Lena, I just heard that on the radio today that a woman who stayed behind in Galveston was very annoyed at the local people, the local police, trying to make her leave. Or suggesting, even suggesting she needs. It's almost like a teenage attitude. I don't want to hear from you.
But, you know, there are a lot of motives for the way industry behaves as it does. The former head of enforcement for the EPA, who quit because he couldn't enforce the laws during this administration, said that companies just like to game the system. It's a game for them not to have to comply with regulations. Which is unfortunate, because if there were a move toward green chemistry, as there now is in Europe, it could create a whole new system of jobs, of opportunities for communities, but it's not happening. If they're not careful, if the chemistry industry is not careful, the same thing is going to happen to them that happened to the automobile industry. When the auto industry was told they needed catalytic converters, they say, no, it would harm the engines. Seatbelts, oh, Americans won't use it. Smaller cars, and no, Americans want bigger cars. CAFE standards, they built the Hummer. And look where the American automobile industry is now. It's losing even its domestic market to Asian and European makers, and that's going to happen to the chemistry industry unless they learn the lesson that they need to adapt to the new green chemistry.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is that consumers don't seem to learn. You know, it's like a lot of us lived through the period where they were building these enormous boat-like cars with huge fins. You know, it was a sign of opulence, and it was fancy and sexy to have a huge, huge car that you could, like, drive around the block before you filled it with gas. And then soon after that, you know, we had a gas crisis, and then the cars got itsy-bitsy like they are in Europe, and that was really popular for a while, and then bang, here we are again with these huge SUVs. So there's something happening in the way that the consumer is being manipulated that's allowing this to continue, and you describe it as manufacturing doubt in your book, and I'd like you guys to talk about that, about lobbyists and PR people. How do they manage to get the consumer along on this stuff, even when it's hurting them?
The PR industry and advertising industry has a lot to do with where we are in terms of our consumer attitudes, including how we look at the products we use in our homes. There is a group called the Council for Water Quality, and what it is a PR company who's serving Lockheed Martin and some other companies that produce rocket fuel that gets into the water and into our greens, our lettuces. But this is the Council for Water Quality, and that's part of the PR campaign. then an even stronger arm seems to be the movement to using science companies, companies that are called, they call themselves product defense companies. And their goal in life is to be hired by a corporation and to do what the corporation says. So there's a group that started with tobacco called the Weinberg Group. It's being investigated right now by Congress for the question of whether, quote, science is for sale at these consulting groups. The Weinberg Group did a study of a chemical called bisphenol A, which I think is very much in the news these days. It's in our plastic and gets is in 93% of Americans' bodies. So it was the Weinberg Group that the FDA turned to ask them to tell them whether the chemical bisphenol A was in was dangerous or not, and it was not much of a surprise when the Weinberg Group came up with the fact they looked at two studies, including one where they tested it on rats that were bred to be insensitive, and they said, okay, this chemical is fine. That's just a tiny example of what goes on across the country. The another cute example is the Aaron Brockovich story.
Sure.
It was, you know, there it is made into a movie, and believe it or not, PG&E repeated the exact same practice on a neighboring community, and once again, a lawsuit was brought, the terms were settled, and all of the families are not allowed to divulge the terms of the settlement, nor does PG&E have to admit that they did anything wrong. This is how law and science and public relations can come together to make it difficult for people to know what's happening across the country.
Politics also plays a role in keeping the American public in the dark about
you
what's
think?
Going on.
You think so?
Well, particularly in this area. In recent years, in this administration, more than any I've seen, the federal government has perverted government science. It has taken reports that show problems. The most famous one is on global warming, but there are others having to do with specific chemicals. And he has either deep-sixed them or ordered them rewritten so that it does not appear as damaging. And the government has also packed scientific boards with industry members. It has put industry people in charge of what should be objective scientific endeavors of government. And it's no wonder that if the government gives these things a clean bill of health the way the FDA seemed to do with bisphenol A a couple of weeks ago, that the public is going to be duped, is not going to know what's going on.
Well, the other thing I think that happens to the public is, I was reading your book, and I've been thinking about all this plastic stuff. I don't drink my water out of plastic anymore, but I suddenly thought about the some of the plastic containers in the refrigerator, and I thought, okay, you know, because you mentioned that as these plastic containers age, I would have thought that they would stop. Sort of, you think of it as outgassing, but bisphenol A is this reactive sort of, I mean, it has this odd reactive quality. It comes out when it's heated, but you would think that even if you don't, gosh, I guess you cannot put these things in the dishwasher because they get hot. I mean, do you know, what do you put your leftovers in the refrigerator in? I guess you go back to using glass bowls for serving bowls or something.
We've tried that in our house, and I must say they're very clunky. And again, here is the most an amazing market out there for products where we could store our foods that were lightweight, perhaps made of glass or some kind of stainless steel compound. So somebody, please put those on the market. In the meantime, yes, use glass and use stainless steel, especially if your child is out there on the soccer field and wants a drink of water.
Yeah, well, I am worried about the children out there, but I'm also worried about us, the adults, too.
Well, you should be.
Yeah.
We wrote about children because, you know, people care about them.
Yes.
Things we may be indifferent to about ourselves, we worry about if it affects our children.
Well, they're the most vulnerable.
Well, they are the most vulnerable, but they're our canaries in the coal mine. I mean, they are most vulnerable, but we are all vulnerable. And if we don't pay attention to what's happening to our children, it's going to affect, it is affecting all of us.
Yes, it is. I need to take a brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're on the phone with Philip and Alice Shabakoff, S-H-A-B-E-C-O-F-F, their book Poisoned Prophets, The Toxic Assault on Our Children. Just a brief musical break, and we'll be right back with our topic. Please stay with us.
Here's a piece of good advice. Think it over once or twice. Be kind to your parents, though they don't deserve it. Remember, they're grown-ups, a difficult stage of life. They're apt to be nervous and overexcited, confused from their daily storm and strife. Just keep in mind, though it sounds odd, I know, most parents once were children long ago. Incredible, so treat them with patience and sweet understanding, in spite of the foolish things they do. Someday you may wake up and find you're a parent too. Just keep in mind, though it sounds odd, I know, most parents once were children long ago. Incredible, so treat them with patience and sweet understanding, in spite of the foolish things they do. Someday you may wake up and find.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We are on the phone with the authors of Poisoned Prophets, Phyllis and Philip and Alice. That's if you combine your names. It's
yeah.
Philip and Alice Shabakoff, S-H-A-B-E-C-O-F-F. I want to remind you that there's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, CD copies, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number 707-874-2772, and there's information at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Did you guys have a website?
Yes, we do. It is poisonedprophets.com.
How,
And Lena, we were thinking in the not-too-distant future of seeing if people would be interested in using that website to find information and to talk to each other. I think it might be powerful if parents had a way of finding each other, even if they're not living in the same state, or even if their child has a disease different from a child of a different family. So please have people remember our website, and
well, we'll put
make it,
it
into that.
We'll put it on our website as well, but say it again.
www.poisonedprophets.com.
Okay.
Thank you.
It's wise to remember, since you brought up the issue of diseases and illnesses, that children are exposed in the womb. So the exposure is during their development, and of course they're developing even after they're running around on the earth, being closer to the ground and smaller. It's interesting, you have a statistic in the book, eating organic food reduces pesticide residues in children 6 to 9 times, so it's still worth doing. Let's talk about...
Can I say something about being exposed in the womb?
Yes.
One of the surprises that I think have appeared on the scene of late is that scientists are beginning to understand that with an exposure in the womb, you can change your genetic code, and this change might show up later in life as an illness such as prostate cancer or Alzheimer's.
So, which we're seeing on the rise.
Exactly. And we're seeing it among the people who are the baby boomers.
Yep.
And the real, and now the children we're talking about are the baby boomers' children. And there's where we're seeing the increases in childhood illnesses.
It's called prenatal programming. And a single hit of some kinds of toxics can set a pattern that will influence people throughout their lives.
So what we're saying about womb exposure is it goes beyond just don't smoke. It goes way beyond that.
Yes. And another amazing fact that we came across is that there are some foods that can actually protect an unborn child from having, let's say, leukemia when they grow up. And those are proteins and leafy green vegetables. So sort of just what your mother told you.
A pregnant woman who is exposed to a toxic substance can lose her child before she ever knows she's pregnant. We regard this as a right to life issue. So many children are lost this way, and seems to us that no matter where you stand on issues like abortion or stem cell research, you should regard this as a right to life issue we can all support.
Well, particularly because after the child is born, it has a right to be alive too, and not to be chronically ill. The womb exposure issue is enormous. I'm seeing in my practice enormous amounts of children, young children with all kinds of endocrinologic disruptions. Thyroids are messed up. Their ratio between their sex hormones is skewed. Young women are, as you said, infertile, and many women are using fertility drugs, which are then getting back into the water and reinfecting other people. These fertility drugs, if you don't get pregnant, can increase your risk of cancer significantly because they're synthetic hormones and they're very strong. So there's a lot of disruption going on, and then it's followed by drugs and therapies that are supposed to fix this and make it better, which makes things worse. It's very interesting what you talk about in terms of aggressive behavior and violence starting in the womb, because I remember the very brilliant... Also, one other sidebar about in the womb exposures that you said about protein is that sulfur-containing amino acids, which are in animal proteins, unfortunately, not in vegetable proteins, are the sort of building blocks for your body to make glutathione, which is your main detoxification chemical. So without adequate amounts of, at the very least, good organic raw milk and some ethically raised eggs, if you're a vegetarian, or if you're not, then go ahead and do eat your meat products, because those sulfur-containing amino acids will make it possible for your body to process the toxins as they come at you. It gives you a fighting chance.
One interesting sidebar there, Lena, is that it's thought that children with autism may have low levels of glutathione.
Exactly. Sure, they can't clear metals and various things.
Yes, exactly. And so that does bring us back to the conversation about crime and aggression and the possibility that...
These are nutrient deficiencies that are brought on by DNA variants that occur from exposure to chemicals.
Yes, or a mother's inadequate diet.
Well, of course, then there's lead. Dr. Herbert Diedelman at the University of Pittsburgh has been doing decades of research. He first found a very close correlation between lead levels and lowered intelligence. But in recent years, he's been found a lot of evidence linking lead levels in young men and, well, I guess in women too, and violent behavior. He's examined prisoners in penitentiaries and found that their levels of lead tend to be significantly higher than those of the average population.
They're also very nutrient deficient in prisoner populations. I mean, there's the work of Stephen Schollenthaler, who went into prisons and also public schools and brought in an uncolored hypoallergenic multivitamin and added that into the diet, took away the junk foods in the diet, and IQs went up, violent behavior went down. It was remarkable.
We often wonder why parents don't realize what they are giving their kids to eat makes an effect on their intelligence and their ability to withstand stress, the stress of American life.
Tell us about Cheerios.
Well, the one story we have in the book about Cheerios was when it was accidentally contaminated with a terrible pesticide. But in general, I really don't know whether Cheerios is a decent breakfast food.
No. You might as well. You'd be better off eating the box. Because when you extrude, it might be more organic too. When you extrude grains, when you process them that way, they tend to get more poisonous. That's what research on animals show, is that they die very quickly if they're fed only cereals, cold cereals, not food.
Well, that was a good one. How about if we add that to our second edition?
Oh, great.
Okay.
You know what I'm wondering here too is, where are all the family values that are being discussed right now, particularly right now? In the public sector, where are all these family values when children and people in poverty are being sacrificed because of these high chemical, high lead, high all of these terrible chemicals? And recent Supreme Court rulings now make it even harder for consumers to hold companies responsible. Where are the family values?
Yeah, well, you might ask. I mean, we certainly profess certain family values. We profess care for our children. We profess care for family. But we don't seem to live up to our family values very well. The people that profess them the most, like the religious right, seem to have a very limited perspective of family values. I mean, it's against abortion, against homosexuality. But they don't seem to devote much attention to what we're doing to our children through the toxification of the environment. One of the things we hope to do is to reach the religious right and enlist them on the side of protecting children, make them understand that this is a very important values and right to life issue. And, we'll see what happens.
So is the left any better historically, since you've looked into the history of all of this?
Well, the left is better in that it believes that the government has a role to play in regulating what industry does. And historically, the left have been supporters of firm workplace rules and regulation to protect workers and environmental values. However, when I first started covering the environment, which was back in the 1970s, and it was a period of great activism, both in the general public and in government. I mean, Congress passed a series of landmark environmental laws. Richard Nixon, a conservative, or what was regarded as conservative in that era, established the Environmental Protection Agency by executive order. It was a bipartisan effort. Some of the most active environmentalists in government were Republicans. That seems to have disappeared when the right took over during the Ronald Reagan era, and it has now become a political divide. By and large, the right is anti-environmental regulation, and the left is for environmental regulation.
You know, a lot of families are eating organic. They're using less toxic materials to clean and renovate their homes. They're getting rid of carpets. They're doing all these great things in the home. And then they send their kids off to the school. And what do they get exposed to in schools?
Yes. The school is sometimes, not infrequently, worse than the home. There is no law governing the water, for example, that comes out of the taps in the school. Nobody has to test it. So it might very well be worse than the tap water that comes out of the parents' home. The schools are wont to use pesticides of an industrial strength when nobody's in the classroom and not tell the parents the day before the school opens again. The playing fields, if they're synthetic, are made of ground-up rubber with ingredients that would raise your hair. And lastly, not lastly, next to last would be the chemicals that are used to clean the schools are often just about as bad as you can find. Yet there are many schools that have programs to use materials to clean the schools that are fairly not difficult for kids. And then what I was going to say, the last is the school food.
And here's one that will have you scratching your head, Lainey. There is law that you can't build a toxic waste sump site within a half mile of a school. But there is no law saying you can don't have to leave any distance between a school and a toxic waste site. And in fact, we visited a school in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, which was built about 100 or 200 yards from a huge mound of waste, polychlorinated biphenyl waste, PCB waste. You can see it. It's like a small mountain right next to the school.
Right, and you can, you know, you can look over at that, and then you can look over at the school and see that they have a cell tower on top of the school in most of these, lots of these situations. And they're also using fluorescent lights in schools, which Magda Havis at Trent University in Canada has discovered produce radio frequency radiation and something called dirty electricity, which causes a lot of illness in staff and children in schools. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. We're talking to the authors of Poisoned Prophets, Philip and Alice Shabakoff. Why don't we switch gears for just a moment and talk about who's out there helping? Because not many of the environmental organizations are actually doing very much. But who is doing stuff? Who's? Let's hear some good news. Who's out there doing good stuff? Who are the good players?
Well, we ran among, we ran into just an amazing group of people across the country. First of all, they're the parents, parents of sick kids, who are organizing themselves. We went to a meeting of the New England chapter of Defeat Autism Now, DAN, and there were 1,500 people there. A lot of doctors and scientists, but mostly parents, and they were enthusiastic and energized and ready to take on the establishment and do whatever they could to make sure their kids get the best possible help. And almost every illness we addressed has groups organized around it. And the environmental groups are doing something about it. I mean, Natural Resource Defense Council is doing a lot. The Environmental Working Group is just doing the most amazing work, bringing to light what industry is doing to children and what parents should, and putting the message across the parent. And then there are physicians and scientists. We worked with Physicians for Social Responsibility. They are sponsoring our book. The head of Philip Landrigan, the head of community environmental medicine at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, is the father of environmental pediatrics, and they're just tireless. There are people all across the country, and there's groups like the Collaborative on Health and the Environment, that is sort of at the center of an emerging environmental health movement. So there's a lot happening out there. And the civil society is, you know, right now is the only sector that's really doing much. We feel that there has to be a political input here, and that, you know, if parents want to protect their children, they have to be active as citizens and voters and elect officials who will understand what's going on and do something about it.
I should mention that all these organizations are discussed in your book. There's many sections in the book where people can read about the people who are doing the good work in Poison Prophets. Did you have something, Jeffrey? Go ahead.
Well, on the topic of civil society groups carrying the water of this issue, I wonder if in your travels and discussions, if there's anybody at either national or at local, you know, state, regional level who is kind of making this their issue. For instance, I know that although the FDA punted on the bisphenol A issue, I believe it's Henry Waxman is actually holding hearings regarding that issue to hold the FDA's feet to the fire. So I'm wondering more generally if there's, in terms of a turning tide of in legislation, governmental action, if there's anybody that you came across who is at the forefront of that.
Well, Senator Frank Lautenberg has...
New Jersey?
New Jersey. Yeah. And others, including Waxman, but it was Lautenberg was the moving spirit behind it, I think, introduced the Kids Safe Chemical Act, which would go a long way, not all the way, but a long way to safeguarding the health of kids from these dangers. It's gone nowhere because he doesn't have enough votes. I mean, the Democrats have a very thin majority in Congress, and the conservative spirit still seems to hover over the Capitol Hill. But you know, one can hope that with a substantial shift in the political winds this year, that his bill would go somewhere and probably open the floodgates for more stuff happening. And certainly, the EPA and other federal agencies who are responsible for these things had a change of personnel. It would help a lot too. But as I said, so far, it's in recent years, it's all been civil society that's doing it.
Historically, too.
Jeff, you do feel when you start looking at this field that there is a remarkable energy among parents and researchers that I think is beginning to coalesce and grow. And it will just take a couple of, more parents plugging into their networks, all of which are listed in our book, Poison Profits. So I do think that there is a groundwork that it's like the environmental movement that led to understanding of global climate change. I think there is this energy that will help push it forward. And the more people who join it, then the better. And the more people who vote for legislators who understand this, the better.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Philip.
But before we get too excited about the prospects for change, we have to realize the systemic reasons for what's going on. I mean, the market economy does not lend itself to responsible behavior by corporations, and there has to be some change that would hold the corporations more accountable for what they do. You know, perhaps a rethinking corporate charters. And before the politics can change, finally have to do something about the role of money in leading politicians to act the way they do. Money and lobbying still controls politics at almost all levels, and we have to get at that somehow. And even if there's a major change between the parties, not too much is going to change unless we change the systems.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I know that there's a very small movement afoot to change corporate chartering, and the issue comes up occasionally. But I really do, it's very similar to the message that I had in the editorial that I presented, that there's more fundamental stuff at work than just money buys influence and evil works. There's a reason why that works that way. And it may sound far-fetched, but it really makes some sense to have corporate charters that are, for instance, from year to year, and that corporations have to demonstrate, since the whole concept of a charter is that you are a public benefit. So I couldn't agree more with what you said.
That's
saying.
One of our proposals that in the book, that corporate charters no longer be made permanent, perhaps not year by year, but contingent on fulfilling the mission that they were originally chartered for. And that's just one of many reforms that are needed to make the corporate presence more benign in our society.
In terms of the citizens groups that you've talked to, has that been received well, that concept? And has there been a perception that the two things are connected, that there is the immediate issue that families, for instance, would be concerned with some chronic illness with children, and the fact that this came from somewhere and that there's, as you say, a more systemic cause? Is there a receptiveness there? Is it opening people's eyes?
I'll speak for myself. Maybe Alice has a different perspective. We didn't see that. The people, the families we talked to, and the civic society groups we talked to were so immersed in the immediate struggle to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish, protect their kids or change the immediate climate for protecting the kids, that there wasn't too much forward-looking. That's one of the reasons we wrote this book, hoping that people will understand what's at stake and how much needs to be done to change it.
You know, we unfortunately ran out of time before we could discuss in detail, but it's certainly in the book, Europe's REACH program, which is based on the precautionary principle, and the green chemistry issue, which turns out that you can make green chemistries less expensive. So we have the lead of Europe, as usual, doing some of this stuff. You know, one of the things that you're talking about that seems terribly important is that there's a kind of, not only are people glossing over or not looking at this, or they're feeling overwhelmed financially, but there's another thing which I notice among the population, which is that they don't want to be too aggressive, and they don't want to be mean, and they want to build consensus, and they want things to be peaceful. And you know, you had a quote in the book that said basically that you can't be a victim. It's not acceptable in this environment to be a victim and to just sit there and be passive. You can't be passive now. And I would add, trying too hard to be nice isn't going to work either, because look at the way that these organizations and rules and corporations are treating us.
That's definitely means
almost complete. Yes, it does. Almost out of time. Just quick comment from you there.
Well, we're accused of being alarmist. We need to be alarmed. We need to overcome disbelief and inertia.
Yeah, and go ahead and say what you had to say, Alice, about organization.
Yes. I think one of the things that seems to have stopped, oh, my God, a community organizer, I wonder what that means, that people have to get together with their neighbors and with others across their not only their state, but across the country, and make their voices be powerful. So I think that we need a little more community organizing in order to get collective power.
And you always start where you are, right under your nose. Like, we're going to be attending a very pivotal meeting tonight in our own little municipality, trying to stop a huge cell phone tower being erected here in the woods, where it doesn't belong at all. It doesn't belong hardly anywhere from where we sit, but certainly not in the woods where it can kill migratory birds. But this is a community organizing, and it's a question of getting canvassing your communities and talking to people door to door. And we found that it's a remarkably wonderful thing to do, and it gets people very close. So I really thank you for your call to action with your book, Poisoned Prophets. Philip and Alice Shabakoff, Shabecoff. Their website, poisonedprophets.com. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Lainey. You were great.
It was wonderful. Thank you, Lainey and Jeff.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, CD copies, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772, and you can also go to sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.